Session number 20094, Reel 5.
George Lester, Reel 5.
Amongst the flag staff, there's always a squadron wireless assistant, an officer, and who's responsible for all the fleet wireless communications for the flag. And the one we have is a lieutenant commander called Meadows. He happened to be in the WT office when the signal came in.
Well, the PO teller of the watch, he came in and tried to kick me off my bay because he wanted to send the signal. You must realise that breaking WT silence in wartime is very, very rare to send signals. You mainly do all the receiving. And the opportunities to transmit are very few and far between. Well, the squadron wireless assistant, Lieutenant Commander Meadows, said, "What are you doing, Petty Officer?" He said, "I'm going to send this signal." He said, "No, you're not. Lester is the operator of the watch. He sends it." And the Petty Officer said, "Ah, but it's a most immediate, which is the highest indication priority of a signal that is possible." He said, "I don't care what it is. He is the operator of the watch. If you want to become a WT operator again, I can organise it. But get back to your position as the petty officer of the watch. He sends the signal." Well, luckily, the transmitter was run up. I switched over. I called up Gibraltar. Got an answer straight away, and I sent this signal about 48 groups of cipher to Gibraltar. I got an R first time that shows it hadn't made any mistakes and he'd received it perfectly. And the added to that, I had the congratulations from the squadron wireless assistant for the correctness of my Morse and all the rest of it, so I was quite chuffed. Mind you, I kept out of the way of the petty officer itself for a little while after that, whenever any off-duty occasion. Perhaps it'd be reasonable to go into what the organisation of a WT department of the capital of the ship was in wartime. For example, the Knowlton's main WT office was below the armoured deck, which I've mentioned before, right beneath the mainmast. She had a second WT office, which was not only manned at action stations. Nobody liked it. That was also below the armoured deck. It was right down by the after pom-pom and 4.7 magazines. Just above the starboard screw. Vibration down there was intense, and the smell wasn't too nice because there was a store area down there as well. We didn't like it because under normal circumstances, it took quite a while to get to the upper deck. With all the hatches closed and with the armoured hatch closed, the only way that can be raised is by somebody above it. So if the ship caught a packet, you didn't stand much chance of getting out. The remote control office in the bridge, which later became known in the Navy as the Bridge Wireless Office, was another WT office, which, as the title suggests, quite a few of the important frequencies like fleet wave and aircraft reporting wave and things like that were remoted to the remote control office as well. The auxiliary WT office, which was down below the armoured deck also, that was near the transmitting station and quite near X magazine. This housed the gunnery control radio equipment, WT equipment, for controlling the gunfire and flank marking and spotting and things like that during the surface engagement. Now, obviously, the only under normal cruising stations in the wartime, the remote control office and the main WT office, they would be the ones that would be fully manned. The second WT office and the auxiliary WT office would be manned during action stations, and also another little one, a little cabin, little tin box virtually behind the bridge, was a DF office that would be manned also. For the types of frequencies in the main WT office, at all times the area broadcast would be read. Now, depending on which area you're in, you read the signals in that area. In the UK, these were called HDs and BNs. And Gibraltar, it would be Gs, and Malta, it was Ms. What is this? That was the serial letter, the letter that went in front of the serial number of that particular signal. Like it would be G, it started at G001, and go up to G999, then start with G001 again. That's for the ones from Gibraltar. Every signal had to be read, because you didn't know whether it was for you or not. Every signal had to be read, and you kept a check on any of that might have been missed by the serial numbers. Gibraltar, were the ones I was mainly concerned with in my service in the Nelson, were called G's. So, as well as the area broadcasts there, and sometimes you might have to, particularly during the times of day when the heavy side of air used to come into effect and you start to have to go to a lower frequency, and you start to go to a lower frequency, tune to a lower frequency, either Pyotr of the watch or the leading hand of the watch used to come in and man another receiver to do the interchange, do the swap over period. As well as the area broadcast, which is red, there were fleet wave, which is generally on a low frequency, around about 210 KC, something like that. There was Admiral's wave, if you were the flagship, which we were for most of the time I was in Nelson. Admiral's wave. Aircraft reporting wave. This is the frequency that the Sunderland aircraft used to be operate on when operating from Jib or from wherever. And so you could receive their submarine reports, so you knew what was happening. And any other frequencies were there, particularly there was the commercial wave, 500 KCs, which had to be manned and kept. On top of that, there would be periodic, what they call the GM routine. This used to be issued, transmitted by Admiralty. And these were the general messages for all ships throughout the world. And these were sent, as well as on a high frequency component, also sent on very low frequency, something like 16 KCs, and that used to be generated by Rugby, the big radio station at Rugby. Incidentally, that was the one way that Admiral used to communicate with our submarines, because a submarine, providing it was steering 30 degrees the optimum course towards the transmitting source, could receive rugby messages while submerged on the try to stay from the conning tower to the to the forecastle part of the submarine. And so they could receive the signal submerged, whereas for HF they'd have to come to the surface. We normally used to operate in four watches in harbour, three watches at sea. That's one in four in harbour, when we should shut down some of the frequencies. Three watches at sea at normal cruising stations, and two watches during secondary readiness. And obviously everybody was fully engaged when we went to first degree readiness action stations. And regarding action stations, it's not known, but every Royal Navy ship in wartime used to have to do dawn action stations whilst at sea. And when you're watch keeping and you just finished come off watch at 4 o'clock and you're in the tropics, and dawn is about about 5:30, so dawn action stations would take place at 10:10, 20 minutes beforehand. You didn't get much chance to sleep. Life itself, again, I mentioned the fact that I was the only boy to take first in HMS Nelson. Before the war, boy telegraphists never kept night watches. In fact, they only used to double bank on bays to learn the trade, so to speak. But during the war, their training was far more comprehensive than that of the ones that were pushing through quickly with 8 weeks, 6 to 8 weeks of Morse training and then sent to sea, as ordinary tells, because they were more adaptable and they had better training. They're not better people, they'd had far better training. So consequence is that when you boy tells when they went to sea during the war were actually doing a man's job right from the very start. And I liked the chief tell, the Nelson, from the fact that he treated me not as a boy telegraphist, he treated me as a telegraphist on the watch bill. It was only when I was out of the WT office on the boys' mess deck that I reverted back to boy again. But whilst in the WT department, I was treated as a telegraphist, and I appreciate it very greatly. Because life on the boys' mess deck was very noisy, because a lot of the boys were what we call daymen, seamen boys, were daymen. They just used to be officers' messengers. Occasionally, some of them were attached to guns crews, but when they were on the guns crew, if they were stood down, had to be in the vicinity of the gun, but they could lay down and get the head down if they wanted to. There was always one lookout provided on the gun on the mounting, so they didn't suffer the nastiness of no sleep. As a telegraphist on the area broadcast, it meant when you went on watch, you actually read signals solidly for 4 hours. There was no stop. And sometimes if the traffic, normally they were normally sent about roughly around about 20 words a minute. But if the operators at the transmitting stations had lots and lots more traffic, they used to just wind up the dial on the potter's wheel, which controlled the speed of the Morse through the sender unit, and they'd put that up to about 22, sometimes 23 words a minute, which is very fast to write for 4 hours non-stop. Because not only did you have to read the signal, But on your message pad, which had two carbons in it, you didn't change carbons, you just get charged pads. You didn't have time to change carbons. And what you said I have to do, at the bottom of your of the signal pad, there is a list of boxes which have to be filled in, like frequency, time receipt, operator, type of code, and the date, and all this has to be put in at the bottom of the signal pad. In addition to that, your first part of the signal, the most important part of the signal, has to be entered into your WT operator's log as well. So as well as filling in the bottom of your pad and your WT operator's log, you have to do this as you receive the signal. So you nip over quick and jot a little letter down here and there as you went along. Because when you got to the end of the signal, it used to finish, and I'd shoot making a few noises, and it used to go, bidee bidee bip, that's the end of message sign, AR, and it'd go, dit, 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 and that was your next message starting off. And that was it. You had no real time. And the coders in the main WT office and the coding office section used to come into the receiving bay, pick up the signals as you finish them, and leave you lots and lots of charge pads by the side of you so you can carry on writing. So that roughly is a rough breakdown. The equipment on the Nelson in the main WT office, we were lucky. We had three new, or fairly new, Marconi CR100s, which in Navy terms was called B28s. But on some of the other frequencies that we manned, particularly GM routines or any other press reports and that from rugby, these were on a very old 1927 or earlier vintage receivers. They were not super hits. In other words, they had a separate oscillator and RF dials. You had to match them. You had to put your frequency on by using a wave meter first of all, and then match them. And they were a much more difficult task. So as well as your operator's logs, you had to do the tuning and adjustments in that at the same time. So 4 hours was quite hectic. It was 4 hours of concentration. It was made even worse when the Americans came into the Mediterranean after the torch operations, because we had an American encryptographic team on board, because we were the flag. We were the flagship. And consequence is that lots of messages for the American liaison officer used to come through. And the Americans used to use type CCM or type X, if it was five-letter codes, instead of the figure ciphers that we used to use. And their signals were always so inordinately long. They were a signal would... normal British signal in naval code or naval cipher would be between 40 and, so we say, 150 groups. Maybe a really long one, it might go up to 200. But the Americans would think nothing of sending a 500 group signal, which meant even at 22 words a minute, with all the preambles and all the rest of it, you're going to take you 20 to 25 minutes to receive. And if one of those started just as you were about to come off watch, your operator, who was taken over from you, your relief, would have to plug his
headphones. Well, this used to happen all the time. You used to plug in, you never used to plug your headphones into the receiver. You had overhead jacks, the twin jacks. He'd plug it, get his earphones, he'd plug into the jacks, listen to the flow of the Morse and that, and get there, and pick up, and gradually move to the side of the operator who was receiving the signal, and ease him out of his seat and take over. And then you'd fill up the he'd fill up his log as far as he could for him and everything else, and sign off. But as I say, those signals used to, particularly during the night watch, a lot of them used to come through, and it usually quite an experience. Another frequency which I haven't mentioned, which we manned in port, it's called port wave, which was quite, I used to like that one, but operating from Malta during later on during the Sicily, Italy and Salerno and all that, because the radius of operations was so close to Malta, port wave really became the fleet communication wave, and submarines used to make their submarine reports on port wave, and it was quite a busy little frequency to operate on. I liked it because that was one. When we were in Malta, I could do lots of transmitting. I'm getting a bit ahead of myself now. This signal, as I said, was sent on the December the 24th, the one I referred to earlier. We didn't go into Algiers. We stayed at sea. And eventually returned to Gibraltar, and we've been Christmas and the New Year at Malta at Gibraltar. Sorry, it was rather funny that on New Year's Day in 1943 we actually had snow in Gibraltar, which was quite a strange thing. And we also, there was a greeting from Force H, to Force H. We continued to ply on our runs back and forwards between Gib and Mersa El Kebir, occasionally going up on patrol. Whenever the reconnaissance aircraft spotted movements of the Italian fleet or signs of movements, we always just have to raise steam and go out just in case. And from there, the 5th Army started doing their advancing. Monty's 8th Army was pushing right the way up through. This is 1943. So when it came to about May, when the Germans were being kicked out of North Africa, and our ships were heavily engaged in supporting the army, particularly our destroyers and the cruisers, the Aurora, the Penelope, and those. We finally got our trip to Algiers beginning of May. General Eisner came on board, inspected the crew, and had a lot of nice words to say to us. And I've got lots of photographs of him. But when we came back from that, and Admiral Cullen came on board, we did a march past to him on board ship. All went well, except for one section went by. One of the crew saluted him with his left hand instead of his right, which didn't go down too well. Anyway, when we came back, the Rodney, she carried on through Jib to go back to UK because she had some repair work done. And we went into Jib. The Howe had come in to Jib, the battleship Howe, to relieve the Rodney. And rumours began to fly around that shortly after that, particularly after the fall of North Africa in May, from the Germans' point of view. The rumours were abounding that we were going to go to UK as well. And lo and behold, we had four German officers, senior officers, generals, that come on board as prisoners of war with their three A's and a few others. And we did. We came back to UK, to Devonport. We landed the prisoners, and we were given 3 days leave each watch because we were only going to be in Plymouth a week. In that time, the ship had bottom cleaned and she had modifications done to her radar to make them more accurate. They introduced a thing called beam switching, which anybody who knows anything about radar and that will know what I mean. But it takes a bit too long to explain other than that. Our radars were modified. We then went back up to Scapa. The Rodney, in the meantime, had gone back to Gibraltar. No, she came up to she came up to join us up at Scapa, and we were joined there by the Warspite and the Valiant, two other battleships. So Force H was now augmented, and we were split into two divisions. The Nelson and the Rodney were the first division, the Warspite and the Valiant were the second division of Force H. And when we sailed from Scapa, we went into Jib. The Warspite and Valiant, they went on, I believe, to Algiers. I'm not quite certain about that, but I believe they didn't come into Jib. Our aircraft carrying Force H was the Formidable. Joining us in Scapa was the newly repaired Indomitable, which had got smashed up during the Malta convoy in the August of the previous year. And so she joined us when we sailed and we went into Jib. We hung around in Jib up until about the 1st, 2nd of July. Then we sailed to Merzel-Kubert again. We could hardly get in because the place was full of American warships, cruisers and destroyers. And we arrived there and they were all flying their very, very big Stars and Stripes ensigns because it was July the 4th, their Independence Day. We sailed from there to from Merzel-Kubert the following day. We went to Algiers, and lo and behold, we found the KG-5 and the Howe were also at Algiers, and they stayed there when we sailed a few days later, or 2 days later. We then sailed along the coast, and it was very, very hot. Very hot indeed.